your marketing bets should be very much like a VC portfolio strategy, which is every single company I invest in as part of my investment portfolio, I need to have a chance of being a fund returner.
That's Emily Kramer, co-founder of Market One, startup marketing advisor, and writer of one of the most beloved newsletters in B2B. And she's got a bold take. Marketing shouldn't just be a list of tasks. It should be a portfolio of bets.
I'm talking about the programs, the big campaigns, your big projects, the things you're putting a lot of energy towards. Like, those big initiatives should have a chance to change your growth trajectory.
It's not necessarily easy, but it's the antidote to what Emily calls random acts of marketing.
Chaotic marketing is random acts of marketing. It's when you do everything that someone ever requests of you, or you're like, this company's doing great, let's do exactly what they did, or let's buy all these billboards, or let's do name whatever new tactic of the day.
In this episode, we're talking about how to bring structure to the chaos, how to make more strategic marketing bets, and how to figure out what your company can actually win on.
Most people start from, what are my competitors doing? What are companies that are larger than me doing? I start from a place of like,
gotta stick around to find out. I'm Chris Savage, and this is Talking Too Loud. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been a fan of Wistia for many years, since I was at Asana 12 years ago, and we were an early customer. And
well,
we tried to emulate your videos, and so you were a hero to us.
Well, that's
a dozen years
really,
ago.
Really means a lot, so.
Yeah.
Interview done.
Let's drop this mic that I can't drop.
the show is called Talking Too Loud because
that's the thing that people
excited.
Have told me my whole life.
Yes.
Just especially my brother. Emily,
and I talk too loud.
Yeah.
You talk too loud. I have to start the show by asking the question, like, what has got you talking too loud? What's got you like pumped and excited today?
That's a really good question. I'll try to keep this to marketing and startups. Because I talk loud about lots of things.
It could be anything.
I know. I think
fair.
What I've been talking, I feel like I've been talking loud about AEO, Answer mm-hmm. Engine Optimization, also known as LLMO and GEO. We keep going. Because I just went to a conference and I spoke at the Ahrefs conference. And so I admittedly hadn't gone as deep as I did before. And so I've been thinking a lot. I've been talking loud about like, what's the future of a website and how AEO plays in that. So maybe I've been talking loud about what's the future of the website because I'm like drumming up a newsletter in my brain on the future of the website. So I've been talking a lot about it.
Well, I mean, let's go deeper on what's the future of a website. Cause I think this is a question a lot of marketers are asking themselves. Will the need for a website still exist? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I used to a while ago, I think one of my most popular Substacks. They've been writing on Substack for, I don't know, 4 years now. So, but one of my most popular ones at some point was about the website. And it was like, started with something like, everybody goes to your website. Your website's your front door. Like, don't make your front door horrible. Like, it's, people can't understand what you do. Make sure you're, this is terrible now, but I'm recapping something. But the point is, this is the front of your house. And if people go there and they don't understand, the metaphor starts to break down here, but like, people don't know what you do and who you're for and why you're better. Like, you're messing it up. And so, and can't figure out how to talk to someone or to buy it self-serve. Like, you're messing it all up. So I feel like now I would have to kind of edit that post because I feel like the website's still really important, but it's different things about the website. I think this will change a lot in the next 2 years. And I think it's just that the website moves to be more of like a down funnel thing is like the general consensus. And that's not that interesting of a point of view, but I think, you know, we used to kind of joke, are we making our website or we're making this content for like humans or bots? But like, it's not a joke anymore. Like, you will be making part of your website to be read by LLMs, and that's okay. Like, there will be pages. We've seen, there's been some posts with people making like very specific pages, like, dear LLM, read this page. Winter with a Y, our founder Pep posted about that this week and caused some like discussion. So yeah, I guess it just becomes more of like a product marketing play rather than like awareness too. And you'll assume that people that come there have some knowledge of your company already. But I think like always, I hope always that we have a place for companies where they can like be creative and not be like stuck in boxes. And in a lot of ways, websites all kind of look the same. So we are sort of stuck in boxes. But like, in theory, you can do whatever you want with your website. And it's like a creative expression. And so I'd be bummed if everything has to fit in a chat box and nobody goes to a website.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's lots of things there. But I'm still working it out, you know? I'm still working out my deep thoughts here.
Totally. But it's funny. I kind of feel like that is why websites are not going to go away. Because like,
yeah,
just as a basic human thing, which is like, yeah, we are going to do more research and find things we wouldn't have found otherwise. That seems clear. Like already, right? Like, even with imperfect tools, you can still learn a lot, like using ChatGPT or Claude to help you like in a research project or something. But then like, if you find something that's awesome and you start talking loud to people about it, like they're not going back to ChatGPT. They're going probably straight to the site. And so like word of mouth is still going to require that. And I also just think like humans like fun things. Like we like entertaining things. And so I think if it can be something that's like, yeah, you're doing it work, but like it's fun and engaging and you can learn and it happens on a website, you won't care. Like we'll be used to websites. But I agree with you that for most people's first touch with you, it's shifting. It's going to be like, yeah, a lot more offsite, a lot more in social and in AI. And then like this, like you need to be ready that people are actually at the bottom of the funnel. Like someone might click get a demo and they actually really know what they want already. And that's very different than where we were like a year ago.
Exactly. And I mean, this just also has a lot of implications, you know, like attribution's always been hard and we could debate like what level of attribution is a good level of attribution. And I don't want to go down that road. I'm not talking loudly about that. I'm sick of talking about that, but that's obviously going to be so much harder and understanding where people have come from is going to be so much harder. So it's creating a lot of challenges that ultimately will probably get fixed and we'll figure out solutions. But there's going to be a lot of like Wild West, even more so than there already is on attribution, I think.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about how marketing has gotten like more chaotic. Do you think it's the like environment, the tools, the like what the culture, like how do you, what do you think has made everything chaotic?
Yeah. The thing that I talk loud about generally is this thing that I call random acts of marketing. I actually have a little.
Is it the RAM?
It's a RAM. It's a RAM
okay. In
a no circle. Let me explain what it is. It's the RAM emoji in a no circle because I say random acts of marketing, which I abbreviate RAM, which is a RAM. The no RAM has become kind of like a thing that people will say, no random acts of marketing. And so chaotic marketing is random acts of marketing. It's when you do everything that someone ever requests of you or that any company ever does. Or a company that you're like, this company's doing great. Let's do exactly what they did. Or let's buy all these billboards. Or let's do name whatever new tactic of the day. And like the problem is that you have a unique audience and you're at a unique stage and you have unique advantages as a company and unique disadvantages. And you need to take those things into consideration before you just start doing a checklist of things. And so that's random acts of marketing. And so you can just like spot it and be like random acts of marketing. And so I don't know if I think that this has gotten... I guess the reason I do think it's gotten a little bit worse lately because I think people are throwing spaghetti at the wall because everything's changed. So they're like, the channels that I'm used to aren't working. What the hell do I do now? And it's like everything. And it's like a scare attack. It's like I'm afraid. So I'm just going to do every random act of marketing I can and like see what happens. But I always tell people like you have to plan for impact and you need to make strategic bets. And yes, you're going to be testing things, but everything you need to test needs to have a chance to be a big winner for you and to drive meaningful growth. And so I spent like a brief couple of years, I guess I had a VC fund for a minute and I still support all of those portfolio companies, but I decided that the VC life wasn't for me. So I invested in companies and helped them build marketing. And so the point of that is that like your marketing bets should be very much like a VC portfolio strategy, which is every single company I invest in as part of my investment portfolio, I need to have a chance of being a fund returner. Everyone is not going to return the fund unless I did was like, you know, the luckiest person alive, but everything has a chance to do that. And that's the bar for your like big initiatives. Could it have a chance to drive huge results for you? And if the answer is no, like probably don't do it. And so that's kind of the approach that I tell marketers to take, not think like a VC, because I don't necessarily want you to do that, but to play strategic bets. And could it be meaningful? And if the answer is probably not for us, then don't do it.
I love that. I love that. It's my language, but I also think it's very, there's a lot in there. And I'm going to unpack it a
little bit. There
is.
That was quite an in-depth monologue. Sorry.
Well, it's not even that. It's just that I think that there's a lot. Actually, what I heard from you and saw in that was like, there's actually a lot of lessons in there that are, many of them are very easy mistakes to make, right? Mm-hmm. So like the idea of like, I see another company doing something and I think they're doing well, mm-hmm. and I attribute it to one thing that I saw,
yep.
which may work perfectly for them because it fits perfectly with their strategy and where their product was and where their company was and the service level. Like, everything came together in this one moment. It just makes it not repeatable. But yeah. You don't know that because from the outside, you just know, I saw this one campaign or whatever. And like, mm-hmm. I think that's the secret. So now I'm spending time copying this thing that may not fit with my strategy or approach at all.
And I think many marketers are like aware of this, and then they get pressure because,
yeah,
you know, someone told someone that told their founder, or their founder saw this thing themselves, and they just feel like they have to do it. And there's so many reasons why a founder or someone else in a company might request you do something. One might be that they actually really want to do it, you to do it, and like it's a hill they're going to die on. You need to do this, and in some cases, you need to give in a little. Sometimes it's like they just don't know what you're doing and they want you to do big things and they don't see it, which means they don't understand your strategy. They don't understand your big bets. Or it like, I mean, there is the answer that they're like just misguided, which is another factor to understand. And then it's again, like, how do I pick my battles here? But I think some people just give in to every single request without like understanding, why did this request come in? Like, what's the root cause of this request? And so there's a lot of like defense that you have to play in marketing. Graceful defense.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Cause like the communicating what you're working on. And if you're in a large organization where you're not talking to the founder every day, but they might be the person who's giving you that directive, like actually communicating to them, like, hey, these are the things we're doing and this is why, to proactively stop it from becoming an issue later. And then the piece that you said that really, really, really resonates is like, I just don't think that most people get to see what happens when something really works like great. where like, you know, like I actually think there's a lot of stuff kind of working, but mostly not seeing things that are like take off. And so therefore you're like, oh, this thing, I think it's working because we've been doing it. I attribute like this value to it. But like, if you haven't seen the thing like get pulled into the market, it's hard to evaluate the other bets properly. Right. Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason why a lot of people haven't seen it is because they don't, because they're spread too thin on random acts of marketing. And then it's like a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
So I start from a place of like, I ask the question a lot. Again, this is like a stupid, simple question, but just how are you going to win on marketing? And I ask that to marketers and I ask that to founders. It's interesting. Often when I ask founders, how are you going to win on marketing or go to market, they say something about their product. And I'm like, well, no, like that's an ingredient, but that's how you're going to win on the product side. Like, how are you going to win on go to market specifically? And then, you know, people will like say some things that they don't really know. And then I go to, well, what are your advantages? I call them marketing advantages. Like, what are your marketing advantages? Like, what do you have to work with? Let's start there. Like, you know, maybe you do have a product that is really differentiated in a specific way. How can you show that? Like, your thing is you need to show that differentiator and lean really hard on that. And you need to do that through educational content, whatever. Like, then you're going to win through educational content, not because of the product. Or like, you could win because you have, you know, this great network of partners and you're going to activate your ecosystem. Like, what is your advantage? What are you starting with? You have a founder with a huge following already. Like, that was the Asana advantage. Those things, like, look to your advantages and like throw fuel on those fires. Don't like play against your advantages. So I think it's like kind of start from within of what do you have to work with. Most people don't do that. Most people start from, what are my competitors doing? What are companies that are larger than me doing? What's this random thing that we saw? And so that's where I usually start with people, is let's like identify these advantages. And then it's very easy to answer how you will win once you identify those. Like, we will win because we have the best partner ecosystem. We have the best community. We already have a fledgling community. We're going to double down on that. Whatever. That's a cliche example, but you get the idea.
Do you think that all marketers can do this?
No, but I wish they could. And I don't think it's because they're not like smart enough to do it. I think it requires looking at lots of parts of the business and distilling that into how is that useful for marketing. And so if you have only worked at a large company in like a specific silo, or you're like really great at one piece of the marketing puzzle, you might not have that perspective. But I think all marketers should be able to facilitate a conversation to do that. Which is like, and I mean, I've written a lot about this marketing advantages concept, but I have like a list of, I think it's a 12 now of like potential advantages, but there's tons more, but these are like the most common ones. And so, you know, anyone can facilitate the conversation, and that conversation should be with a number of like leaders in the company to figure this out. I mean, I think like this is marketing strategy. When people are like, what's a marketing strategy? Like, this is it. What are our advantages? How are we going to use those to win? What are the big bets we're doing in reaction to those advantages? What are those big bets that are going to drive impact? Those big like portfolio strategy bets. And then let's go do them. And obviously there's some like little things you have to do behind the scenes and like ops things, like you have to hire and you have to build out systems and tools, but like, what are the big things? But normally when you look at a strategy or a set of goals for a marketing team, like you just see KPIs with like no plan behind them. You're like, we're going to hit this pipeline number. Are you? How? So I think, again, it comes back to what are these advantages? What are your strengths? How are you going to win? And then what are the big projects that you're going to execute to try to move forward on that? And so, yeah, I think if your marketing leader cannot do that or facilitate that discussion, you're going to end up with a bunch of random acts of marketing. Again, unless you're really, really, really lucky, which also happens. There's always the caveat, I think, yeah, with all things totally. Startups, it's like, unless you're just really lucky.
Yes. If you get very lucky on often timing.
Timing, yes, that's what it means. Like if the timing just hits and you do something and it just like the random thing you do just happens to like go and everything, the stars align. But usually that's not actually what happened, even if it looks like that happened.
Yeah. Do you think there's if you're hiring for somebody to help you with this, mm-hmm. is there like a personality that you think is...
ENTJ. No.
Well, I wasn't going for that exactly. But like, yeah, I think
only know your... like one of those, which is mine. I'm an ENTJ, but I don't know the other ones.
But you're ENTJ, is that what you said?
At least like when I did it in high school, and then I think that's what I am too.
But
yeah, probably.
But also, I'm not sure. So there you go.
Yeah, I don't really know. And then the Enneagram thing is like just confusing to me when people are like, "I'm a Type 8 with a 2 wing," and I'm like, "What?"
Yeah.
But you're known as the commander.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Intuitive, thinking and judging.
Yeah.
Confident and decisive.
It's blunt, not the best. It's
blunt
not the
and
best.
Critical. It's not the worst.
It depends on how you look at it.
Everybody's something. So
everybody's something. And you got to play to it, right?
You got to play to your advantage.
Everybody wins. It's
play
fine.
Your advantage. Know who you are. And if you're an ENTJ, you got to lean in.
Yeah. But anyway. I guess I'm wondering, because like when you talk about this, it all resonates with me. It's like someone who's like high agency, you know, they are able to go their own way on something. They're able to like put the pieces together and be honest about what the company is really good at and not, and like what they're gonna stay being good at, like what's possible. And then I think it is like everybody has to prioritize. Like I don't care how big the company is.
Oh yeah, that's marketing's number one skill set is like, can you prioritize? But again,
so then
what?
It's just can you? Yeah, and I think there's just really something cool about your idea of like that every bet should be able to be a fund returner.
Yeah, it's a big one for me
because I don't think I have not heard that many people talk about marketing in that way, and it makes sense to me. But I want you to go like. I think we should kind of spin into this a little bit more. Like, what does it mean to be a fund returner? And I have things that I'm guessing you mean, like mm-hmm. whatever you're doing is somewhat scalable. Like you could keep doing it. There's, mm-hmm. you might have a glimmer of, it might look at the beginning like, oh, that worked. Or like, there's a glimmer of something here. And then eventually like, you're actually still doing the same thing.
Changes your trajectory in some way. And like, yeah. I think there's two things here. One, it could be that it's completely scalable, or it could be that just that one campaign or that one moment just change your trajectory and the level of awareness so much that it's the gift that keeps on giving, even if you're not like continuing to execute that campaign. Like some things on the awareness side can do that. So I should specify that like, I recognize that there, again, like I said, there are things you're going to do that you kind of like have to do are table stakes that aren't going to be fund returners or marketing returners. I need to figure out the lingo here. but you are going to do some things that are smaller in size. But I'm talking about the initiatives, the programs, the big bets. I call them like campaigns, but your big initiatives, your big projects, the things you're putting a lot of energy towards, you know, the sort of coordinated efforts that require the whole marketing team, like those big initiatives should have a chance to change your growth trajectory, which is like a fund returner. Or basically, like you could also say, you know, should be able to drive your growth in a meaningful way as one of like a few key drivers until the next fundraising round. The definition could be many things, but it's just, it's more just like the metaphor of like, it's, I used to call them like step change drivers. Mm. You can think of it that way too.
Yeah, it's because I've talked a lot about how like often we underestimate how far we can take something that's working. Like if you build something, it's often we overestimate how easy it's going to be to get something working. But then once it's working, we underestimate how far you can take it. And like, it's just, especially if you're mostly talking about people online, but like the world is so big. There's so many people. Like if you find people who all really want like purple coffee cups for some reason, and they're just like, these purple coffee cups are so sick.
Have you read The Purple Cow by Seth Godin?
Yes, I think that's why I thought of that.
I thought you must have. That's like one, it's such like a simple marketing book, but that's like one of my favorite marketing books. Nobody ever mentions it. It's really, okay, that's good. Cause I mentioned it and I'm like, is this like a simplistic, I just like it. It's just so simple to remember. Like, what's your purple cow? It's like such a simple, it's like the no RAM emoji. That's my purple cow, you know?
Yeah, but it is the thing that you can like, as human beings, it's hard to think in like millions and billions. Like it's hard to think about how many people are out there.
And it's funny,
you know? And so like,
I'll tell you why it's funny in a second.
Yeah. So like, I feel like that's what I'm often looking for is like, if we can get 100 people doing something, that tells me we can get 1,000. Mm-hmm. If we can get 1,000, that tells me we can get 10,000. If we get 10,000, I know we can get 100,000. You know what I mean? Like I look at these steps and the first 10, you can actually get a sense if you talk and sit with people and they all love that specific different thing. You're like, well, there's something, you know what I mean? And it's kind of amazing how small something can be at the beginning, but can be a signal of like this future potential.
Yeah. So the reason this is funny is because my partner who works in healthcare, not anywhere near this world, which is a good thing for this ENTJ. It's a good thing. People are going to think I'm like really into Myers-Briggs. I don't care at all.
I don't care. I hate it.
I mean, I guess I care. Whatever. It's not a thing for me, but it's great if it's a thing for you. Whatever works. But my partner is always, every time I hit like a new newsletter milestone, she's always like, how are there that many marketers? And I'm like, no, there are more than 65,000. Like, just hit 65,000. Like, there are more than 65,000. Thanks. Yeah. There are more than 65,000 marketers. Trust me. And she's like, I don't believe you. And like, even then this morning, same comment, like, I how many marketers really are there, Emily? And I'm like, more than you think, Megan.
Yeah.
Infinite. I'm like, every company pretty much has marketing after a certain size. But yeah, I'm like constantly trying to prove to her that there are like more marketers in the world that I can go after. She's like, you're going to run out of people to subscribe. I was like, it'll be okay if I do, Meg.
Yeah.
But the real point there that I like is like, I talk about like the concept of getting mileage out of things, which I think often gets like thought of as like repurposing content. Like, let's take this podcast and chop it up. And that's not what it means. It means like, how do you build from here? I mean, it can mean repurposing stuff, but I think the like other thing that I ask people, I have a lot of frameworks, sorry, but like one of my other frameworks that I've had for a long time, that's like, so again, it's like so stupid and simple, but it works really well for explaining marketing to non-marketers is like, in marketing, there's fuel and there's engine and you need to balance the fuel and the engine, and the fuel is all the creative things you make, the words, et cetera. And the engine's how you distribute those. And a lot of startups have this totally out of whack. They have like, they're spending so much time doing like outbound emails, but they have absolutely nothing to say. There's no fuel, or they like create all this content and it just sits and they don't distribute it. And so it's out of whack in different ways. And these things need to, the fuel needs to match the engine, vice versa. And it also needs to match with your audience and your company. And so you've got to get this balance right. And so I ask this question a lot as well. This is like, again, like, how will you win? Super basic questions. This is what you do as an advisor. You just come in and you ask the same. How will you win?
Yeah, sounds fun.
And then they pay you. It's great. No, do more than that. But also, like, I asked the question of, if you didn't make anything new for the next 6 months, what would happen? And most people are like, oh, we'd be absolutely fine if we just distributed the content that we have, depending on where, what scale you're at and like how much you've put out. And it's the same thing with probably like new campaigns or new programs or new initiatives. It's like, what if you did nothing new and just doubled down on the things that are working? Like for at a certain stage, like you probably actually do better in some ways.
Yeah, that's pretty wild to me that like a lot of that question and that answer, like what would you do differently? Or sorry, now I just lost my train.
It's just, if you made nothing new, if you, you made like no new content.
Like, right.
Yeah.
Like that you're just sitting on amazing content.
And like, you know, I'm like, it's a little hypocritical when I say that because I make new content like every 2 weeks, but like I also get paid for making new content. So it's like different for me. But if you're not getting like paid to make new content, it's like a really good thought. And even then, but, like I don't have something good to put out. I'm not going to put it out.
But like the place that you have in your readers' lives is the same.
Yeah.
Right. Like you're giving them tidbits and of advice and insight and inspiration to kind of like
so much think inspiration.
Well, to think about their jobs. Yeah, tons of inspiration. It's just full. There's 65,000 people who are getting inspired.
Very inspirational. Yeah.
No, but my point is like it's like you get the you subscribe to the newsletter and then you start reading it and you keep reading it, and then it's like, yeah, some percentage of your week is like with Emily. And you're you know what you're getting.
That's weird to think about.
Yeah, but I think it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
And I, because it's like, yes, the what's going out is different every week, but the place it holds, I think, and the readers.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Life is the same.
Mm-hmm.
In a good way. That's kind of what I mean.
And, yeah.
But also, it makes me think about like your point on sometimes I think like we as marketers get bored of their own shit. And so we're like, change it.
Oh, yeah. We get bored of our
And it's like, Geico still has the caveman ads.
They do?
They do.
Yeah.
They still have the lizard, the gecko.
And the gecko.
God bless. But I love them all. I love them all.
I believe it was over 20 years ago they started doing that. And they found this thing that somehow worked. And yeah, it's not the same ads, say, but it's similar
same
characters.
Concept. You're just like rejiggering the ingredients into a slightly different recipe. The thing about insurance ads that's like kind of crazy was Geico the first one to just do like these ridiculous, like nonsensical ads? Because now they all do it. And this is like an example of like copying the strategy. Yeah. And I guess Progressive kind of made it work with Flow, but it's like a similar level of like stupid, quirky, but they all try to do it now. And I'm like, maybe be serious.
There's also like obviously a place in the market for that now, right? It's like,
yeah. I think with these insurance companies, the point is like everybody's doing the same thing, but like there's definitely room to differentiate in a huge way. And I'm like, don't see any of them taking it. And so, you know. We'll see what happens next. But I think startups do the same thing. We converge to the same thing. And there's such a temptation to do that, but maybe don't.
Yeah, it's so hard because like you see something and if you really like it, you assume that other people will like it. And maybe they will. But I think about like the Apple demos when they used to demo, like Steve Jobs would come out and do the
thing. And now everybody does that.
And now everybody does it. And now Apple does pre-recorded videos.
Yeah, as they should.
Changed it up. No, it's just interesting. Like,
wasn't
that it's like
Microsoft, though, the first one to do it when Steve Ballmer was dancing funny? You know that was, like,
yes.
There's like the video of Steve Ballmer, like, is it Steve Ballmer? Steve Ballmer's like going crazy, and Bill Gates is like
developers, dancing awkwardly. Yes. And he's sweating like crazy. And yeah,
the whole
that
thing.
Was definitely before. I was around the same
time. I'm gonna have to do a timeline check. But
I'm not sure there was like another way to do it.
But Apple really popularized it.
Yes.
And made it like the sleek design, empty stage.
Super elevated.
Super elevated. And so now it's like, yeah, maybe someone should just do their announcement in a garage, you know?
Yeah, do it. Yes, exactly.
I like garage announcements.
Oh, did you see this campaign last week that was from Runway, the financial thing? The burn rate thing?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, you're obsessed with this thing.
I'm not obsessed. I just think it's cool. They released a hot sauce called Burn Rate. And they said, we raised a bunch of money. You haven't heard about it yet because we've put all of our money into this hot sauce. The hot sauce costs $13.99, but it comes with an actual $100 bill like underneath the label. So if you buy the hot sauce,
you get $100.
You're taking the $100 with them.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good. I hadn't seen somebody else do this. It's felt very unique to just them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're like a financial forecasting business trying to get like help you and figure out how to get your customer acquisition cost lower. And so it actually makes sense for them in a way that wouldn't.
Yeah.
Everyone shouldn't just go make hot sauces now with $100 bills in them. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see some.
Something similar. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. People just copy things.
Okay. So obviously AI is here. AEO, you talked about before.
I've heard about the AI thing. Yep.
You've heard about it. Mm-hmm. What do you think it should really be changing for marketers today?
That's a good point. So if not obvious, I come from like, I try to approach marketing from like a very like first principles framework-y, not playbook. There's a difference. Framework's like a structure and a playbook. It's like, do this place. And so a lot of the fundamentals, like balance, fuel, and engine, make a match for your audience, like focus on, you know, fewer big bets, make sure they can be fund returners, as we said, like all of these things stay the same. But I think a lot of the, some of these things that you need to do have actually become more pronounced. Let me explain. So some of the fundamentals have stayed the same and like the place to start from and the like guiding principles of marketing, I think kind of stand the test of time. But I think there's a few things that have changed that I've been talking about. And I think there are, and I wrote about this recently, so I'll just like say what I wrote, which is that I think there are like four big things that are really, you need to focus on now to kind of like stand out because of AI and adapt to the changes that have happened to channels and to how we create content and all of that. And I think because of AI, with everything seeming so fake and AI slop-like, said that in a weird way. AI slop.
All the slop, yeah.
All the slop. I think people now more than ever, this was always true, but I think authenticity and differentiation matter more. So all the things we've been talking about. I think people like want real shit. So that I think is more important than ever. So I think finding your marketing advantage and figuring out how you're going to stand out and having like real authentic ways of communicating matter. And I think that also means that things like smaller events and things like, you know, relying on experts and influencers and partners that already know your audience is even more important. So I call that ecosystem marketing, using third parties to grow. That's more important because of this, because of that desire for like human relationships and authenticity. That's only going to get more and more the case when everything becomes kind of fake. Like, I think people want things that are real. Back to the website, like, do we just need a creative expression for a company? Hopefully. That's kind of a more like hand wavy thing. I think one of the other big things that's changed because of all the like data that's available is just that we used to be living in like a reactive lead based world. And now you can know all the accounts that you're going after, even at a pretty big scale. Whereas like, I remember when I was at Carta, like we were targeting VCs and I was like, oh, this is so great. Like, there's only like 5,000 VC firms in the United States. And so we can just know who all of them are. Like, what a concept. Like, you couldn't dream of doing that at the time for like 20,000 companies. And this was like 6 years ago. You could do it for 5,000 with some like Apollo and Zoom Info, but you couldn't, but even that was like an effort to like catalog and then make strategic plans for and divide, you know, filter them, sort them and tier them and make strategic plans for each. So if you're not mapping out your audiences and understanding who they are, and at least for like the top tier of accounts, knowing who they are and tracking progress against them, I think you're going to have a really hard time. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. That need a better metaphor for that versus just like waiting for them to swim to you. Like, we don't need to do that anymore. And that doesn't mean inbound is dead. It means inbound plays a different role.
Yeah.
I think that is just like something that has changed. Like, we are now capable of identifying and mapping the accounts we're going after and systematically going after them. So like, don't sleep on that. And we just didn't have that data before. And so tools like Clay or Pick Your Tool are making that so much easier. So that's a more like, just, you have to change your foundation of how you're doing things on the upside and even strategy side to account for that. And then one of the other big things that we've talked about a lot is like, I think that with AI, generalists are going to take over marketing teams in a bigger way. We've gotten so far into these silos and like, what do all these roles mean? And I think that to stand out and to do these big campaign bets and to like, because standing out is harder, to just like rise above all of that, you have to have generalists who can orchestrate campaigns across all of marketing. And so I decided that since everybody else is making up role names, that I would do it too. So I call this a gen marketer, GEN, which is an expert in generative AI, a generalist. And the third one's a bit of a stretch, which is like ready for the generational shift in marketing. That one's kind of funny.
Oh, there you go.
But it's a gen marketer. And so a gen marketer basically is like T-shaped. They have breadth and depth, but they're really good at orchestrating across all of these things, using AI, bringing functions together. And they're not a specialist in every single thing, but they know enough to work with specialists and outsource some of these specialties. And we're already seeing as teams get smaller. So I think that this generalist skill set becomes even more valuable, and the ability to orchestrate and execute these like well-timed, differentiated, throw all the great adjectives in front of it, campaigns. And that's what's going to make you stand out. And that person also needs to understand, or those people, the generalists need to understand, or marketing leaders too, how to build teams that are a mix of in-house humans, contractor external humans, and AI. Call them agents, call them whatever, but building these hybrid teams and hybrid workflows.
Love that.
I've given this a little thought, is the point.
Well, that's great. No, I thought that was such a good answer. Super solid way, I think, to like end the show. Emily, where can people find you?
Yeah, so my Substack is spelled MKT1. I forgot the vowels. I apologize. We call it Market One. So newsletter.mkt1.co, or just mkt1.co. That's my newsletter, Substack. I'm also on LinkedIn, just my name. And I had a podcast last year. We'll do another season. It's called Dear Marketers. That's also just in my same Substack. Those are the main places you can find me.
Perfect. So good to see you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a fun time.
Hashtag no RAM.
No RAM. No RAM at all.
No RAM.
No more RAM at all.
I like the sticker. I like the concept. Strategy is so interesting to me. Like, I don't think I'm naturally strategic. Are you? Do you feel like you had to learn it?
It's a good question. I don't think I understood how much of a role strategy would play, and having a very clear strategy would play. And then over time, as the company grew, like how it was like critical to have a great written down, easy to understand strategy for everyone. Because basically it's just permission to move faster in the right direction on things and have things make sense together. And I've certainly made the mistake at points where we did the like random acts of marketing. Mm-hmm. And it was confusing because you're like, oh, well, this is working. I understand what's working. It's like, no, you're actually often distracted by that. And yeah, well, like, there might actually be a strategy insight that was useful, but it would be like layers beneath the marketing itself.
Yeah. I think you also have to be really, what's the word? You have to be able to say like, the pressures like around me, like the pressure from the founder, the pressure from, you know, the competitor, whatever, like you have to be able to really say, nope, like this is my strategy and I'm sticking to it. And like, I'm not going to get interrupted.
You have to play your own game.
Got
to
play your own game.
Yes. And I think it is so easy to get distracted. And that's like actually how you don't play your own game, right? Like you stop playing your own game because you saw someone else doing something, you're like, oh, that should I be doing that? Or you saw a competitor doing something, so should I do that? And yeah, if you're the same as everybody else, you're never going to get the outsized return.
It's good, good heady food for thought.
We love it. We love it. Well, another great episode. Thanks for joining us. Please don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you watch or listen to Talking Too Loud. And of course, you can always email us at ttlpod@wisia.com. Or you can find Sylvie and I on LinkedIn, where we're both quite active. You're getting much more active by the day, I can see, Sylvie.
Am I?
Oh, yeah. It's you're wild out there. And until next time, we'll see you in 2 weeks. All right. Bye, everybody.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.